This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson, and we are discussing the RSO's Classic Six concert, Tchaikovsky and Bartok, on Saturday, April 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. The first piece featured in this concert is Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto in D, which was written around the time of what one biographer termed the crisis years, 1874 to 1878. Why such a description?
Well, Tchaikovsky had a number of crises in his life, but this is probably the big one. Everybody knows today, probably knows anyway, that Tchaikovsky was homosexual. This is something, however, that Tchaikovsky was not quite so sure about early in his life. As a matter of fact, when he was 28, he fell very passionately in love with a Belgian soprano named Desiree Artaud, and would have married her except that she refused to move to Russia. About 9 years later, he married and ended up marrying a former piano student of his. He was not in a good psychological place at that time, and he was looking for some solution in his life that apparently she offered. Well, it was a disaster, and he had an emotional breakdown. They lived together about 2.5 months, and after that, he never saw her again. But he had a writer's block at that point. He couldn't write anything, so he decided to go to Switzerland to try to put his life in order, and spent quite a bit of time there just sort of getting his act back together. Going back to the homosexuality, though, after this, he started to become more and more comfortable with this until finally he was as out and open as you could have been at that time. It was no secret that he was gay. There is still a theory that he killed himself by drinking water he knew was infected with cholera at the time of his Sixth Symphony, because he had been exposed and the Tsar ordered him to kill himself. Well, I don't think that that's true, but he was a man with very, very many mood swings, and you can hear that in his music, certainly. But he went to Switzerland to recover, and he was having a really hard time writing his G minor piano sonata at that time. And a pupil of his came to stay with him for a while, Josef Kotek, a young violinist who had studied composition with him. And Kotek was also gay, and they had some kind of a amorous relationship during this time. But I think Kotek helped him through this period and also helped him as he began to write a violin concerto. And this violin concerto was originally intended for Kotek to perform. But Kotek got cold feet. He was not quite sure that I guess he felt that being closely associated with Tchaikovsky was somewhat risky at that stage in his life, and he declined to have the concerto dedicated to him. So Tchaikovsky then approached Leopold Auer, famous concert violinist of the day, and presented him with a score fully printed with a dedication to Leopold Auer, expecting that Auer would do the premiere. And Auer looked at the piece, and in retrospect, looking back at it about 30 years later, he said, I just found this piece to be extraordinarily unviolinistic. There were passages that were just not suited to the instrument. So he took it upon himself to rewrite some passages or try to rewrite some passages, and it hurt Tchaikovsky's feelings very much. So Tchaikovsky ended up withdrawing the dedication to Auer and instead dedicated it to Adolf Brodsky, who ended up doing the premiere in 1881. And Auer would go on to perform the piece later. He changed his opinion about the work. This is another one example of sometimes composers write pieces that change the whole way that the instrument is perceived by performers. Tchaikovsky was not a violinist. He was a pianist. So whatever he worked out violinistically, he worked out with Kotek, not to Auer's pleasure. But this is a must do concerto for any violinist today. I think it's the most popular, most often performed violin concerto in the literature, perhaps after Beethoven. And it's a piece that you must do if you want to have a career as a concert violinist. It was not a success at the time. Edward Hanslick, the famous Viennese critic, wrote famous comment. This proves that music can exist that stinks to the ears. And that's so ironic now, considering how popular this concerto has become.
He didn't mince any words, did
no.
he? Well, actually, I was going to get around to that, so I think we covered that part of it. But wasn't it true that Tchaikovsky had completed the violin concerto, but then made some changes based on advice probably from Kotek, but also from his brother as well?
You know, I don't know about his brother. That's a feature that I missed. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
He was in very – it's very possible because during this time, during this period of depression when he was in Switzerland, he was in very close contact with his family who were being very supportive of him. So I know that he was in contact with his brother quite a bit then. As far as whether his brother suggested anything about the concerto, I'll look that up.
All right. Well, obviously, as you said, the violin concerto has been one of the most popular violin concertos. Describe what we will be hearing in this piece, if you can.
A typical concerto, in some ways, a three-movement form, the longest movement being the first movement, the most extensive, written in what is a there are some exceptions to the sort of the normal concerto form of the time. For instance, there isn't their big double exposition in the first movement. The violin comes in fairly close to the beginning, but a very lyrical opening theme that turns into fireworks later on. The second theme is more of a moody canzona that has found its way into a lot of popular of venues, into movies, into video games, if I'm not mistaken. I've actually used the second. Monty Python, I believe, actually took up the second movement. And the last movement is a dazzling sort of a gypsy dance kind of a thing. Lots of gymnastic leaps and bounds in the violin and very gymnastic and very exciting to listen to and very exciting to watch. Watch and listen to. It's a difficult piece, but it's probably less difficult than it looks and sounds to the violinist, at least today.
Well, now and you're going to have a guest violinist. What can you tell us about her?
Soonbin Lee is a young Korean violinist. She's made quite a hit in her native country and is now based in New York, where she is managed by young concert artists. We've worked with a lot of their young artists before. Young Concert Artists is an agency that's actually a not-for-profit group that every year auditions promising young instrumentalists and composers and takes a number of them on under their wings and mentors them and makes them available to orchestras at reasonable fees to try to get their careers started. And it's done a great job. We've worked with them quite a bit in the past and have always been very, very happy.
Tremendous. Well, now we move on to Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, and I believe he immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1940s as the war was raging on there in Europe, but had all but given up on composing prior to this. Why did he give up composing?
You know, Bartok is one of the great enigmas in history. He's probably one of the more difficult composers to know and to understand. He's a little bit like Brahms in that way because, first of all, he was very taciturn. He didn't talk very much. He didn't discuss things, didn't write a whole lot of letters. There are people, friends of his, who would recall sitting down, meeting with Bartok after not seeing each other for years, and they would sit there and stare at each other and smile because he just didn't have a whole lot to say. He is certainly today recognized as one of Hungary's two great composers, the other being Franz Liszt. When he got to the United States in 1940, he entered a country that was pretty much uninterested in his music completely. There are only a few people around that were really interested in performing his music. Fritz Reiner was one of them. Fritz Reiner was a student of his in Budapest. Other pupil of his, famous pupil, was George Scholte, who was for many years the music director of the Chicago Symphony. But Bartok had a very interesting start to his career. He was a brilliant young pianist, made his debut at age 11, but in his 20s became very passionately interested in studying folk music, along with a fellow countryman, Zoltán Kodály. And the two of them packed up a portable gramophone recording machine and went out to the far reaches of Carpathia, Romania, Hungary, Transylvania, to these little towns and villages, and recorded and notated the folk music that they found there. What's significant about this? Well, the one significant thing is that Bartok and Kodály essentially founded the study of what we call ethnomusicology today. But what they found is that the music of Central Europe, and particularly of Hungary, was not, as everybody believed, just gypsy music. You know, you'll hear a lot of Brahms music, Hungarian dances and things, with a lot of gypsy elements in there. There was certainly some of that, but the gypsy stuff was mostly in the cities, apparently, the big cities. And the farther you got out, the weirder the music got. And this folk music used different scales, a lot of pentatonic scales, five-tone scales, but some exotic scales too, mixed meters, changing meters, which is something that just didn't happen in folk music elsewhere. It was a very exotic, strange-sounding idiom. And he and Kodály notated this music very systematically as to where it came from and analyzed it. And this had a profound effect on Bartok's own composition. He began to use some of these tunes and some of the style of the tunes in his music, which is going to automatically give his music a kind of a foreign sound. It didn't sound like Central European music of the time. It didn't sound like Brahms. It didn't sound like Liszt. So he had a little difficulty in getting, even in Europe, having people perform his music because of this rather exotic-sounding milieu he was in. And on top of that, really it wasn't until after he died that another Hungarian, Enno Lendve, did a study of his music and found out that Bartok had come up with a completely different way of writing music, of a completely different theory system that anybody else used, partly based on the principles of the golden section, the golden mean, the classical proportional device used in Greek temples and things, and the Fibonacci series of numbers, where every you start with one and two, and add one and two together, and you get three. Add two and three together, you get five. Three and five together, and eight, 13, etc. Developing a system of writing a music theory based on these principles. So his music is coming out sounding like nobody else's in the whole world at this particular point. And being new is not always and advanced and different is not always necessarily a good thing. So he came to the United States, and virtually nobody over here was interested in his music. Had he not come here, his last composition probably would have been his String Quartet No. 6, which he wrote in 1939 in Europe. He was not writing anything in this country.
Well, and then he also, did he not develop some personal difficulties at this time, too?
Well, he began having shoulder problems shortly after he got here, and it spread then to fevers, and wasn't, I think, until about 1943 or 44 he was actually diagnosed with leukemia, which eventually would kill him in 1945. But he was very ill during this time, and also kind of strapped for money. When he came here in 1940, Columbia University gave him an honorary doctorate, and gave him a stipend to do research into folk music at that time, but that really wasn't much. Friends tried to help him by giving him cash, and he was reluctant to take it. And he's really, he and his wife Ditta were just struggling to make ends meet until 1943, Serge Koussevitzky, the conductor of the Boston Symphony, came to him and commissioned him to write a piece for the Boston Symphony, which became known as the Concerto for Orchestra, and also became his most famous and most often played composition.
How would you describe the Concerto for Orchestra?
In so many superlatives, we don't have time for it, perhaps, but let's just talk about what a concerto for orchestra is. I mean, that's kind of a unique, I don't think he invented that term. I think somebody else had done this beforehand. But this is a five-movement piece. Why not call it a symphony? There were symphonies in five movements before that, and this piece in a lot of ways looks a lot and sounds like a symphony. This sonata allegro forms and a couple of the movements and slow, fast alternation, a scherzo, and things like that. Bartok himself said that he wanted to call it a concerto for orchestra because the sections of the orchestra were treated as virtuosic soloistic elements in their own right. So every section, every instrument has something very challenging and very prominent to play somewhere in the piece.
Well, that sounds very interesting. Oh, and I think we should remind people again that folks will be able to get up close and personal with Subin Lee at Sound Bites on, what is the date?
Friday, of the
26th,
yes.
Can you give us a rundown once again about Sound Bites?
Yeah, please come to Sound Bites. It's a great way to get out. It's springtime. It should be a wonderful day at Montesi Country Club, which is where we hold these events. And you order lunch, and I talk to the soloist, and we don't analyze the music. We talk about what life is like as a soloist. And it's always particularly interesting for the younger ones to see how they got to where they are and where they're going with their career.
Yeah, that would be interesting. So we're going to be experiencing the music of Tchaikovsky and Bartok at the Coronado Performing Arts Center on Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. during the Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classic Six concert. For more information about this concert, sound bites, and more, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.